Warp fans, movie fans, welcome to Time Warp 1995, the winter movie season, part two. Of course, when we originally recorded this, it went a little long, and we released the first episode talking about November and December, and of course, a bunch of the pop culture with music and television. Make sure you go back and check out part one of the winter movie season of 1995. In this episode, we're going to be talking about December of the winter movie season, part two of 1995 movies, and we're also going to be discussing the award ceremonies coming up a little bit later in the show. We talk about, of course, the Academy Awards and those wonderful Razzie Awards. But before we start, we wanted to also include the comments on our Facebook post that I did, where I said, what were your favorite movies of 1995? And I wanted to include all the wonderful comments that you guys participated with, starting with, of course, the top 10 grossing films. And first of all, I want to thank all of you guys that participated in that post. I'm going to read those now. Well, as for the top 10 movies, we had, starting at number 10, Jumanji with $262 million. At number 9, we had Waterworld at $264 million. At number 8, we had Casper at $287 million. At number 7, we had Seven, of course, at $327 million. Number 6 was Batman Forever at $336 million. Number 5 was Pocahontas at $346 million. Number 4, GoldenEye at $352 million. Number 3 was Apollo 13 at $355 million. Number 2, Toy Story, $363 million. And number 1 was Die Hard with a Vengeance at $366 million. A lot of you had some great comments. I'm going to read those now. Starting with my friend Chuck Pierce, he said, how the hell did Waterworld outsell Jumanji? Jesse Baker replied saying, Chuck, Waterworld was a huge train wreck. Costner, however, was still a big enough name at the time, and while that flopped in the U.S., it did well overseas. Yes, it did do well overseas, but eventually it made quite a bit of extra money in the States as well. There was a re-release, and of course, video did really well. And believe it or not, the big financial flop that Waterworld we all thought was going to be actually made money, believe it or not, and it still has. Nathaniel White said, thanks for getting Kissed by a Rose stuck in my head, Kevin. You're welcome, Nathaniel. That, of course, was the breakout hit of the Batman Forever soundtrack, which is a movie I'm actually very fond of, and we did a Couch Potato Theater earlier this year with Kyle and Haley, so make sure you check that out. Johnny K says there's some bad movies on this list. Yes, there is. In 1995, there was quite a few bad films, but he says, I'm taking Crimson Tide, Heat, and Braveheart over most of those listed above. Matt Berry said, GoldenEye, hands down my favorite of 95, and there were some crackers that year. Crackers, I think he meant probably stinkers. William J. said, GoldenEye is my freaking jam. Johnny K. said, we know Dracula, Dead and Loving It is too. The first movie I ever walked out on. And William J. replied, I could walk in on that movie anytime. I think the movie I walked out of was Ready to Wear. God, that movie was bad. My buddy Cat Cedar said, Heat and Casino for sure. I also like Desperado, Mallrats, and Empire Records. Yes, cheesy, I know, but a fun movie to watch. Those are great choices, Cat. Heat and Casino for sure. Definitely Desperado. Loved Mallrats and Empire Records as well. By the way, we will be doing Desperado on a future Couch Potato Theater here, so make sure you listen for that. My buddy Dan Lee said, oh, man, Seven, Mortal Kombat, Vampire in Brooklyn, Mallrats, Billy Madison, Major Payne, Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, Clueless, heck yeah, just to name a few. All interesting choices there, some good ones there. I got to watch Vampire in Brooklyn again. I think the last time I saw it was in 1995. I was very underwhelmed by it. Never did see Major Payne, but I did see the other ones. Scott, our co-host of the What a Piece of Junk Star Wars podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network, he says, Mortal Kombat, Mallrats, and GoldenEye. A lot of love for GoldenEye. Our buddy Magnus said, Mortal Kombat, Desperado, Tank Girl, Godzilla vs. Destoroyah, Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, Judge Dredd. It was a great year for movies. Yes, it was. That's why we did this podcast. Iconic year for movies. Our friend Polly said, off the top 10, it's Seven and GoldenEye for me. Lisa Van Dillon says, "While You Were Sleeping, Tank Girl, Die Hard with a Vengeance, Jumanji, and Ghost in a Shell." Kimber Spores replied to Lisa, said, "Tank Girl is love. I absolutely adore that film, and I'm planning on reading the comics." I love that film too, guys. One of my favorites. I remember going to see a midnight showing of that. Tony Back says, "GoldenEye." Kimber Spores again says, "Waterworld was amazing in my opinion. I'm a sucker for films that others don't like." I would agree with you, Kimber. There's a lot of films I like that people do not like. Our friend Lacey Adderhold says, "I think Home for the Holidays is fantastic. I watch it every year at Thanksgiving and likely again at Christmas." Also, for the podcast, you could do a whole show just on 1995 tech trio, The Net, Johnny Mnemonic, and Hackers. You know, that would be a fun show, actually, Lacey. I think we would have to get Leon because his dad, whenever he went to the movies, I guess he was a tech guy, and he would always say, "That's not how computers work." It's funny how some of those films haven't quite aged well, but they are a lot of fun to watch. Charles Ecton, my buddy, says, "Species, for two reasons." I think I know what two reasons you're referring to. Chris Gagolin said, "Jumanji, then GoldenEye." A lot of love for GoldenEye. My buddy Stevie McLeod, last but not least, there in Glasgow, Scotland, he says, in his top eight in 1995 are 8, Waterworld; 7, Die Hard Venge; 6, Judge Dredd; 5, Jumanji; 4, Outbreak; 3, 12 Monkeys; 2, Braveheart; and number 1, 7. Thank you guys so much for your awesome comments. We really, really appreciate that. Thank you for participating. And we hope that you enjoy the rest of this Time Warp 1995 Winter Movie Season Part 2. All right, guys, we're going to get into December here. We're going to try to get this, but I don't think we're going to get in under 2 hours. We got a lot of stuff to get into, so I'm going to do a bigger group here, and you guys can pick and choose here. We got Rumpelstiltskin, starring Max Grognchik from Deep Space Nine. We also got, what do you got here? Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, Annie Garcia, Christopher Walken, Christopher Lloyd, White Man's Burden, John Travolta, Harry Belafonte, Kelly Lynch, Wild Bill, Walter Hill directed with Jeff Bridges, Ellen Barkin, and John Hurt. And we've got Georgia with Jennifer Jason Leigh and Mare Winningham with Ted Levine. Sense and Sensibility, the ultimate chick flick. Emma Thompson, Kate Winslet, and James Fleet, directed by Ang Lee. Othello, Lawrence Fishburne, Kenneth Branagh. And we've got Heat, Michael Mann with Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, and Val Kilmer. Alex?
You know, it's funny, you look at all these, and others mentioned, not mentioned here, Father of the Bride Part 2, one of the bigger sequels to come out at the end of the year. I'm actually going to go with White Man's Burden. I saw that one in theaters. It's a very uncomfortable movie. Because the entire concept is, what if whites were the minority and they were the ones that were put upon all the time? And, it's an interesting concept and I'd love to see it done with no budget. And instead you get Harry Belafonte and the hero of this story, which again, the end result just feels like, man, white people got problems, it doesn't really hold very well, especially when it's John Travolta, who had already had like a huge year. I don't know if this was an Oscar bait film or if it was just a case where Travolta wanted to test just how good he could do. The movie is awkward and has a really downer ending. But it's the biggest problem is in a systemic racist society that we are in, it is very difficult to look at a movie in which the white guy says, "Look at all the problems that I have that's caused by the black people." It kind of makes Powder look like an appropriate film for children.
Yeah. Lee.
I was going to say, very similar things with White Man's Burden. It was poorly executed. It would have been a good idea, but too many people were at the time, like oh yeah, we're, you know, in 10 years, you know, white people are going to be the minority. And that's been going on forever and ever.
I would love to have seen John Singleton take a stab.
Oh God, that'd have been great. Because I think the things they do in Denver when you're dead is amazing. Love that movie.
Good soundtrack.
Oh yeah. Very good. Gabrielle Anwar, who, you know, I still love, just finished a rewatch of Burn Notice and she's still looking good. But just a great movie. It's kind of like following on the Pulp Fiction wave, you know, of kind of kitschy and
Two Days in the Valley, criminals. Very similar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wild Bill, I consider this to be the prequel to RIPD. because Jeff Bridges is playing the same. I truly believe that he's playing the ghost of Wild Bill Hickok throughout that movie.
I thought you were going to say it
also like Wild Bill. Nobody saw RIPD.
Yeah.
It was really good. Really too bad because the was it Ellen Burstyn playing Calamity Jane?
Yeah.
It was a pretty good performance.
She's underrated in everything, though.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The only movie that should be spoken about in this group is Heat. One of the best action movies of all time, the best shootout of all time. They actually use the shootout at the for the U.S. Marine Corps Infantry School to show proper fire teams
and proper retreat
movement from cover.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, or repositioning or displacement, as they like to call it. You never say retreat, especially Marines. That's too many syllables. But but just a fantastically done movie, beautifully shot, very much a cat and mouse. Very you don't have a moral high ground on any of the characters. Absolutely fantastic. And one thing I noticed is there's a lot of parallels with Ronin.
Yum.
They've got the one guy that messes everything up in the first job. You've got like all the double crosses. And in both movies, De Niro's getting jobs from the man in the mansion. I may watch too many movies. may have too many things, but there is not a bad moment in Heat. I think just a fantastic movie. And here's how many times I watched it. When my brother-in-law got a new TV with surround sound and everything, he's like, yeah, I need to check my speakers. We should do Heat. We should throw on the gunfight scene. I'm like, yeah, it's chapter 42. And boom, he's like, how did you know that? I'm like, come on, dude, it's Heat.
What really makes that shootout effective is no music. It's all sound effects. And it was one of those things too, that when the LA shootout that happened with the bank robbers in LA, the real thing that happened, where luckily no bystanders or police officers were killed, but people were interested. Only the gunman eventually ended up getting killed. Everyone was like, oh my God, let's watch Heat.
Yeah.
Kyle.
Yeah. Well, we talked about it with Heat. Of course, Heat, also another podcast that Kevin and I listen to. I think it's the only podcast that's revisited the same movie at least three or four times in its existence. I gotta do it because we have real co-host Alex with us and his partner in crime, Michael Morris, the other real co-host, Godzilla versus Destoroyah. He would be heartbroken if I didn't mention it, because it is actually a key film in the Godzilla lore, because it ended an era of Godzilla, because at the end of this movie, they killed Godzilla. Godzilla had a nuclear meltdown, and that was the end of an era for Godzilla. He wasn't brought back again until about the late 90s, early 2000s. I remember desperately wanting to see Godzilla versus Destoroyah. It made a very limited theatrical run in like off the wall theaters, mostly after it hit a DVD and they played that. I finally saw a fan sub version of this film. And, you know, if I didn't mention it, I got to honor Michael Morris just for Alex, just to keep real co-hosts alive.
In the contract.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, guys. Next, we've got Jumanji. We got Sabrina. We've got Nixon, Balto, and Cutthroat Island and Dracula Dead and Loving It. Let's go to you, Lee.
Here's the one. Sabrina. I absolutely love this movie. I think it is probably the best remake that has ever been done. I think it's the only person that could have improved on Audrey Hepburn's performance as Julia Ormond. She is so believable, both as the awkward Sabrina and as the glamorous Sabrina. Her transformation is very natural. Her character doesn't change even with the appearance, and it fits on both sides of the coin. Beautifully done. I think Greg Kinnear is absolutely perfectly cast in this one as David. Harrison Ford as Linus. In the original, Humphrey Bogart, the actor, looked uncomfortable, not the character. Whereas in this one, Linus, the character, looked uncomfortable. And it was really well done. And Harrison Ford had this great little anecdote about Humphrey Bogart. When he was first getting into acting, he's talking to an agent, and the agent's like, you just don't have that star quality. Because, like, you know, Humphrey Bogart's first movie, he was just a busboy. And he walked across the scene, and the director looked at him. He's like, him, that's a star. And Harrison Ford's like, well, if he was any good, you'd look at him and say, oh, that's a busboy. But Sabrina is a top 10 favorite movies of all time for me. Just fantastically well done movie. And it was one, again, if I hadn't put this print together, I would never have seen it. But I absolutely love the movie.
Alex, why do you like Cutthroat Island so much? I forgot.
The German definition of Schadenfreude is happiness at the misfortune of others.
You know, we didn't even plan that, and you threw it right back in my face. Well played, sir. Right, there you go. Right back in your
face. Hell yes, I'm going to talk about Cutthroat Island. Cutthroat Island was a train wreck. Nobody at the time thought that it was a good idea to do a pirate film. And even Disney has only proved that it's okay to do once. the biggest thing about Cutthroat Island, the biggest thing was, you know, it's Gina Davis and her husband. It's not
Rennie Harlan.
Rennie Harlan. Thank you. I get Verhoeven and Rennie Harlan confused all the time because they're both, you know, Eastern European hacks. This movie killed Carl Coe. It killed the company. The movie was so bad, it killed the company. And when it came out on video, I was working at a rental place by that point because I had upgraded. Our company legitimately had a deal where if you rented Cutthroat Island and you didn't like it, you got a free movie. We lost so much money off of this. And it's one of the things, you know, it's not a matter of can an actress be a strong, can lead an action
Matthew
movie.
Matthew Modine was not the right actor in that role.
And he was the second choice because by the time they had done all the rewrites, the character had gone from being an equal to being a subservient. All right. Mm-hmm. You take a movie. Okay. Take a Long Kiss Goodnight.
Great film.
That is a phenomenal,
fantastic movie.
The lead actress in that is wonderful. Cutthroat Island, the lead actress is garbage. It's the same woman. All right. Cutthroat Island is absolutely, do you know why you watch Cutthroat Island? Because at some point in time, you're going to get to see Gina Davis go, bad dog, and shoot a cannon at somebody. And that happens at the end of the movie. So get it on DVD, go to the end of the film, watch that, watch the biggest damned explosion of a ship you've seen in film, and then go, okay, I've seen Cutthroat Island, and it was terrible.
This actually reminds me of a comment I made about Chris O'Donnell when we were talking about Batman Forever. Is Chris O'Donnell in that movie was walking around like amused because he's too good for this, but he's still like, you know, doing the cool kid in the lunchroom, like, yeah, I'll do this for a joke. That's what Gina Davis, like the whole time, you know, like the bad dog line, everything else is like, she's finding it amusing instead of like doing work. And I actually tried to go back and watch this. And after I watched it, I'm like, wait, what was this about again? Like, oh yeah, a map on her dad's skull and like really bad stuff. And I still think this is weird that Frank Langella considers this and Skeletor to be two of his favorite roles.
Because he got paid to do nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Kyle? Right. Exactly.
I'm sorry. The map on the skull thing wasn't funny in Yellowbeard, not funny in Cutthroat Island.
Okay.
Do not speak ill of Yellowbeard. I love that movie.
It's still not funny.
Kyle.
Okay. First of all, not only did this movie kill Carlico, it did kill Gina Davis's career because I don't think she's ever been seen since this film.
Well, Long Kiss Goodnight, we already mentioned that one.
That come out after?
I mean, okay.
But after that, other than that, it was the Olympics.
But I think she I think she filmed Long Kiss Goodnight before she actually filmed Cutthroat Island.
Yeah.
But come on, guys. If we're going to talk about any movie, it's the fact that in about 3 weeks, we're all going to yell, Jumanji! Because that's what the year 2020 has been. One never-ending game of Jumanji!
It's the only way to explain Murder Hornets.
Yeah, exactly. I remember this movie. It was a little off the wall even for Robin Williams at this point, but there was something about it that just was so appealing. And honestly, truthfully, these spinoffs they have done with The Rock and Karen Gillan and stuff have been so much more entertaining than the original film. But the concept behind Jumanji was so well done. And I'm so glad that this concept of Jumanji has survived. It actually even made a very interesting Saturday morning cartoon for a while on the WB network that had an interesting animation style. It was actually very well done. But yeah, just the world that Jumanji created and how it's been carried on through these new batches of films. And yeah, there's still the magic of Robin Williams, no matter how you cut it. You're always going to have that Robin Williams magic. And like I said, in 2020, we're just all waiting to yell Jumanji.
Grumpier Old Men. I liked those movies. I thought they were kind of fun. Even the second one.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
It's just a fun little movie. Yeah,
great, great. The second one was just as entertaining, I thought, if not even better.
Oh, yeah.
It was good.
And Sudden Death, saw it once, never seen it again.
Yep.
It's the first bad instead of good bad Van Damme movie.
I just want to say, how dare they give that glory hound Balto his own film?
All right, guys, let's get into the last set of films here in December of 1995. We've got Waiting to Exhale, Forest Whitaker directed, starring Whitney Houston, Angela Bassett, Loretta Devine. We've got Four Rooms.
More Angela Bassett, what's by that? The way. More Angela Bassett. Yeah. This is her third one.
She's on a roll.
She's been busy. So
we've got Four Rooms with Tim Roth, Antonio Banderas, Sammy Davis. Dude's on a roll, man. Jeez. 12 Monkeys. Terry Gilliam directed. Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe, Brad Pitt.
Oscar nomination. Yep.
Dead Man Walking, directed by Tim Robbins. Susan Sarandon starring, Sean Penn. We've got Mr. Holland's Opus, directed by Stephen Herrick, and stars Richard Dreyfuss, Glenn Headley, Jay Thomas. And we have Restoration, Robert Downey Jr., Sam Neill, David Thewlis, and Richard III to round it out. Kyle, let's go over to you.
It beelines right to Mr. Holland's Opus. This is one of my all-time favorite films. It is maybe my all-time favorite Richard Dreyfuss performance. I saw this movie. I went to the movies by myself to see this. I wanted to see it. I can't find anybody who was even interested in going with me. It was so good. My mom, who is not one to go to the movies very often, I dragged her to it, and she thanked me for dragging her to the movies to go see this film. This movie hits everything. It is so poignant. It is so heartfelt. It is written so well. The performances across the board are great. Incredible music. And I am sorry. One of the most tear-worthy moments at the end of the film when spoiler alert for a movie that's been out for 25 years, but when you have Mr. Holland walk in and there are all the students throughout the film and he's asked to play an American Sympathy. Symphony.
Symphony.
Yeah, Symphony. And
this is America. We don't have sympathy.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And the symphony is phenomenal. It's one of still to this day one of my favorite score pieces in a film. But I can watch this movie anytime. I would classify it as a couch potato theater film in the aspect of no matter when I come across it on cable, I'm stopping, I'm watching it. I don't care if it's in the beginning of it or I'm at the end of it. I also, you know what, another moment that stands out to me is when he is singing to he's for so long not been able to connect with his son who's deaf. And then it finally clicks with him, the music and how he portray the music after John Lennon's death and everything like that. And to have that moment when he does Beautiful Boy to his son, I don't think there was a dry eye in the theater at that point. I mean, this to me is just an amazing special movie. I know it's on Disney Plus now for streaming. If you have children, if you have not seen this film, whatever, watch this movie with your family, young, old, whatever, because there's something in there for everybody from the generations from the time this movie takes place that can talk about those times to showing a younger generation what music is and what history is. It's easily in my top 15 all time favorite.
If you want to have some appreciation for teaching.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that it's on Disney Plus, Kyle, because I've actually never seen it. So now I got to watch it. You sold it.
Oh, you have serious homework. You
sold it.
You have serious homework.
I've been hearing it's a good film. I just never got around to watching it. So, Alex, what say you on this last group here?
Breathtaking line for me in Mr. Holland's Opus. And it's a line that those of us who have seen it will get immediately. He was nobody, just a guy I taught to play the drums. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard scene. I'm glad that somebody else mentioned Mr. Holland's Opus because I was actually balanced on this one. Richard III, Ian McClellan doing the story of Richard III.
Robert Downey Jr. in this one as well.
Yeah, yeah. And again, this is one, the basis behind this one is that it's done as if it's Nazi Germany. It's Europe in the 1940s or late 1930s. And Richard is very much a Hitler-esque character. But what was fascinating to me, because at the time I was really getting into the Shakespearean stuff and I missed Othello. I don't know why I missed Othello. I just did. So I got to, on a snowy day here in Georgia, went to a small four screen theater that doesn't exist anymore because it was in the parking lot of Perimeter Mall. And saw this with a buddy of mine named Tom. And we were just fascinated by this film.
How is Annette Bening in that, by the way? Cinematography.
She's excellent. She's excellent in everything. She wears clothes all the way through. So it's not just the dress shirt, which kind of makes it a downer. But she's great. And everybody in the film is great. But it's really weird. When you watch this movie and it's Ian McClellan and you just watch it and you watch it and you go, that's going to be Gandalf.
Yeah.
And he's a Nazi.
I want to say I saw it on television eventually and I was fascinated that it was set in World War II.
Yeah. But I mean, the sequence at the end where the coup to topple him is taking place. And it's this big bombastic explosion sequence where he's running through an area. And of course, he's still got the hunch. He's still, you know, hunched over, looking like Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein. And he's just running through the field and he yells out, a horse, my kingdom for a horse. And it's that moment. But like he spends the entire time talking to the audience. He breaks the fourth wall throughout the entire film. And right at the end, right as his character is about to die, the guy who killed him turns and looks at the camera. And you go, oh, they've just had a balance of power shift. Mm. And it's so
that, cool. That was the news about that, was breaking the fourth wall. I remember that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lee.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Anything else, Alex?
No, I was just going to say, just simply because the way that, I mean, Richard III's a tough one to sit through. And it's one of those ones where if you don't have somebody explaining kind of what's going on, you can get lost. And in this one, Richard was telling you his motivations, why he was doing it, and how he was going to do it. And that made the film even deeper.
All right, Lee.
Well, I mean, it's hard to, you know, go over Mr. Holland's opus. I mean, it's just, it is one of those fantastic movies, and it shares an actress with the movie I'm going to talk about, Four Rooms. Alicia Witt.
I'm a huge fan of Alicia Witt. A little crush on her.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And in Mr. Holland's opus, she was the clarinet player. Mm-hmm. And he says, "Oh, why don't you give up?" And he's like, no, I just meant for today, not give up completely. And then she shows up and she's
just,
the
just real quick. I just want to say she was in, I forget the name of the sitcom in the late 90s, I think with Christine Baranski. She was in help me out there. Someone Google that. But she's also become a regular on the Hallmark Channel.
She was on Sybil.
She had a great role on Walking Dead.
What was that, Justified. Alex?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was on the Sybil Shepherd.
The daughter. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Maybe I'm getting Christine Baranski mixed up there. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I think Baranski was on that
show. Okay, too. That's where I remember her then from. Okay, yeah, she was. Baranski, I think, stole like almost every scene that she was in. So yeah.
Alicia Witt sang with Randy Newman on the TV show Ally McBeal. It's your useless facts for the day.
She dropped an album. She's a pianist and singer.
Yeah.
Beautiful. She's really good at both. But Four Rooms was one of those four different directors directed different segments. And it really is the beginning of the relationship between Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino.
Yes.
They had been friends before, and Tarantino had dropped in for that great scene in Desperado. But this is the first time that they were directing segments.
Also an Ione, together.
They would go on to
also
do that
an Ione Sky appearance.
Oh yeah. Yep. And a wonderful scene. Yeah.
But the one with the coven. But,
yeah.
I thought so.
Yeah. But yeah, as time goes on, we get Sin City out of this. We get Death Proof and Planet Terror out of this. You know, the friendship and the influence that these two had on cinema, very similar, their love of kind of trashy action movies, elevating the art form to what we have today, I think is, you know, I mean, heck, 2 weeks ago, Robert Rodriguez directed an episode of Mandalorian.
Yeah, he did. It was a good one.
But the stars that were in Four Rooms, I mean, you go to the IMDb page and it just keeps on going and going. I mean, you got Bruce Willis, you got Madonna, Ione Sky, as you mentioned, and they're really trying to do something with Tim Roth. I really wish that he had gotten bigger, but he really had fun. And it was reminiscent of a movie that came out a few years earlier, Blame It on the Bellman.
Yeah.
Starring Balky, Bronson Pinchot.
Bronson Pinchot, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow, Bronson Pinchot also made an appearance well in this 1995 Time Warp. Wow. There you go.
I said it before.
Okay, guys, I'm really surprised that no one has brought up 12 Monkeys. And I'm surprised that I'm talking about 12 Monkeys because the last time I saw it, I was not a fan with it. But it was the last time I saw it was not the first time that I saw it. Kyle, why are you holding up your finger? I'm talking.
I know, but there's a reason for that. Nobody talks about 12 Monkeys because nobody actually understands 12 okay. Monkeys.
This is my point. 12 Monkeys for me holds a very special part of my movie nerddom history. It was the first time I got invited to go to a pre-screening. You know these things where you have a test audience? I went to the 12 Monkeys test audience in, I don't think it was Burbank or something like that. I forget. And a friend of mine told me about it. I went along. I'm like, what's a test audience? He's like, oh, you get to see a movie before it, like, you know, 6 months to a year before anyone else does. And you get to give your opinion on it after you see it. I said, all right. And we weren't told what it was. It was except that it starred Bruce Willis. All we were told. I'm like, I'm in, let's do this. And I remember watching it, and I remember at the end of it I was like, huh? And when they gave us those questionnaires and those little cheap small pencils to write out what we thought, I remember I was like harsh on the ending. I was like, what's this? What's going on? The ending sucks, blah, blah, blah. Then when it came out in the theaters, I saw it. I'm like, okay, they changed the ending. That's fine. Why is this? I still can't understand this movie. Why didn't they listen to me?
Wait, what was the original ending?
I'm having trouble remembering because it's been so long since I saw the original ending and have seen the ending that is now in the movie. So I got to go back and rewatch it, to be honest with you.
Shut up. 1995 was 8 years ago. What are you talking about?
It's Terry Gilliam, so more than likely a group of British police officers storm the set and just arrest everybody.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And this is the beginning of Bruce Willis time travel movies with confusing endings.
Yeah, there you go.
Was it the end of them?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Time travel.
All right, guys, we're going to take a little quick break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about the awards for 1995. But first, check out our... I'll let you know what's happening around the Fandom Podcast Network. Our little promo. Here you go.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We like to continue to feed your ears by inviting you to listen to the Fandom Podcast Network and all of the other awesome shows we have to offer. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture news podcast. Blood of Kings, our Highlander podcast. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating our favorite movies. Time Warp, the Fandom Flashback podcast discussing a year in movies and our favorite pop culture topics. End Zone, the NFL podcast. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Union Federation, our Star Trek and Orville podcast. Hair Metal, the 80s and early 90s rock metal podcast. Type 40, our Doctor Who podcast. Lethal Mullet, a 1980s and 90s action film podcast. What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast. And our newest show, Making Treks, a new Star Trek podcast with a deep dive into the final frontier with host Mark Newbold and Adam P. O'Brien. You can enjoy all of these great Fandom Podcast Network shows on our master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. Fandom Podcast Network is also on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. You can also find us on Facebook under Fandom Podcast Network. You can also email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter under Fandom Podcast Network. Thank you for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
All right, guys. So first of all, before we get into the awards, I want to just mention the top grossing films of 1995. Number 10, we had Jumanji, followed by Waterworld, Casper, 7, Batman Forever. Rounding out the top five was Pocahontas, GoldenEye, Apollo 13, Toy Story, and the number one box office winner was Die Hard with a Vengeance at $366 million. Just barely beat out Toy Story at number two with $363 million. All right, guys, let's get into the award ceremonies here because I want to ask you guys where it kind of holds up now, the films that won, didn't win, what have you, do you think, they were, chosen well? The Golden Globes, okay, first of all, best director was Mel Gibson for Braveheart. Best performance on motion picture was Nicolas Cage, and then for Leaving Las Vegas and Sharon Stone for Casino. Best performance in a motion picture musical comedy was John Travolta for Get Shorty and Nicole Kidman to Die For. Best supporting performance in motion picture, drama, or musical was Brad Pitt for 12 Monkeys. I guess for the drama. Then we've got the Cecil B. DeMille Award, which is given to Sean Connery. Bunch of presenters as well. But let's get into the Academy Awards, the real awards. 68th Academy Awards ceremony was done on March 25th, 1996. This is where we had actress Whoopi Goldberg host the show for the second time. Braveheart won 5 awards, including Best Director and Mel Gibson. But let's get into this here. Best Picture was, of course, Braveheart. Other nominees were Apollo 13, Babe, The Postman, Il Postino, and Sense and Sensibility. Best Director, Mel Gibson won for Braveheart, but we also had Chris Noonan for Babe, Tim Robbins for Dead Man Walking, Mike Figgis. Leaving Las Vegas, and Michael Radford for Il Postino. Best Actor, Nicolas Cage won for Leaving Las Vegas. Nominated Richard Dreyfuss, Mr. Holland's Opus, Anthony Hopkins, Nixon, Sean Penn, Dead Man Walking, and then Massimo Troisi for Postman. Best Actress, Susan Sarandon won for Dead Man Walking. Nominated Elizabeth Shue, Leaving Las Vegas, Sharon Stone, Casino, Meryl Streep, The Bridges of Madison County, Emma Thompson for Sense and Sensibility. And for Supporting Actor, Kevin Spacey won for The Usual Suspect for Verbal. James Cromwell was nominated for Babe, Ed Harris for Apollo, Brad Pitt for 12 Monkeys, and Tim Roth for Rob Roy. And to round out the main categories, we have Best Supporting Actress, Mira Sorvino wins for Mighty Aphrodite. Nominated Joan Allen for Nixon, Kathleen Quinlan for Apollo 13, Mare Winningham for Georgia, and Kate Winslet for Sense and Sensibility. We had honorary awards for Chuck Jones and Kirk Douglas, and a special achievement award for John Lasseter for Toy Story. Alex, I want to go to you. Where and how does this award stack up now for you?
Let's face it. Nicolas Cage is, he's become enough of Nicolas Cage that we can just say he's Nicolas Cage. Kevin Spacey is brilliant in Usual Suspects. And unfortunately, thanks to the Me Too movement, he is persona non grata. And so is the movie Usual Suspects. It's funny looking at this because there are like actors and actresses that I remember winning and didn't. I remember Susan Sarandon winning for Dead Man Walking, but I swear I remember Sharon Stone getting because I remember it being a really big deal that she was nominated. And I guess that's just kind of weird.
She got the Golden Globe. That's why. Yeah. Yeah,
she did. And that's the thing. Looking back on it, I don't know that. I guess Nicolas Cage earned it over Richard Dreyfuss, but it's weird when you look at Dreyfuss and Hopkins and Penn, and the winner is Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, but Hopkins was horrible in Nixon.
Yeah, but everybody was horrible in Nixon. That was just that was an Oscar bait film.
Yeah.
So. And I don't think anybody involved with Il Postino was even remembered after this film.
Kyle?
This is one of the years, Kevin, I know we listened to it on some other podcast. There should be like a 5-year rule for the Academy Awards, how those movies hold up in 5 years before you actually give them the awards. But in this case, I think for the most part, the movies themselves and the performances themselves hold up. What's more interesting is the fact that how many of these things went wackadoo with the people involved down the road in history. I mean, Braveheart, phenomenal film. Mel Gibson deserved to win Best Director for it. Should have won Best Picture, but Mel Gibson went wackadoo. Nicolas Cage, mm-hmm. Leaving Las Vegas. Amazing performance. This is when Nick Cage was still a legitimate actor. Nick Cage is now hosting a show on Netflix about the history of curse words.
Can't wait for that.
Mm-hmm.
Best Actress, Susan Sarandon. That was a, you know what? We haven't given you one of these yet. You did earn what you need. You deserved one of these because Sharon Stone should have won it.
Sharon Stone, yeah.
For Casino. Yeah. But
Elizabeth Shue.
Or Elizabeth Shue.
Good performance.
Yeah, but just, again, you take a look at that lineup because you've got Shue, you've got Sarandon, you've got Stone, Meryl Streep.
Emma Thompson.
Miss Oscar nominations. Yeah. Emma Thompson is wonderful in everything. That was a weird one. I don't know, but again,
that was a career achievement for Susan Sarandon.
Yes. Yeah.
That was one of those. The Oscars is notorious career achievement. Kevin Spacey should have won for Usual Suspects. He's gone. Obviously that's a whole modern monstrosity.
To me,
Kevin Spacey is not a supporting character in that.
No, that's the other thing, but
he should have been the best actor,
but he wouldn't have won for best actor.
Mm-mm.
True.
He wouldn't have won for best actor because face it, the way that film is played out, Gabriel Byrne is the lead actor.
Yeah. And then Mira Sorvino, It's a Woody Allen film. I haven't watched it. She's had an up and down career, I think, to say the least.
This was the height of her career. This was it.
This was
the zenith. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Well, you got the Replacement Killers, which was actually pretty cool.
Cool movie, but
I'll give that to you.
Yeah.
She was good in that.
And the Oscars just had to come up with a special achievement award for John Lasseter because they didn't know what the hell to do with Toy Story.
Yeah, that's literally what the case was. Animated films did not get nominated. They broke the mold with Beauty and the Beast and then didn't know what to do when another one came along. So the very next year they said to start doing, or a couple of years down the road, like within 5 years, because I think Shrek was nominated for best animated.
Lee, I need to revisit Rob Roy. I wasn't a huge fan of it, but I tell you, Tim Roth to me stood out in that movie. And is much as good as Usual Suspects was, he was my favorite to win in that because I love Tim Roth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was fantastic. The level of fencing that he was able to do in that movie, because it's almost completely him, is just, I consider this to be a better sword fight than Princess Bride.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Princess Bride is better executed. Princess Bride is better executed from a cinematic standpoint, but there is no comparison to the choreography. And there are several different ways to watch that sword fight. And kind of see, okay, is Liam Neeson lucky? Or in the second version, is Tim Roth stupid? Or in my personal preference, he knew he couldn't win the straight sword fight, so he lured him into this place where he would gloat and do that fight, because that's what he does all throughout the rest of the movie, is he's luring people to a weak point. But
it's kind of like watching really the good Kurgan get people drunk first before he tries to kill them.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. I will say with Braveheart, to me, that's not a Best Picture movie. It's a fantastic movie. I love it, but it's not a Best Picture movie, but I'm looking at it against the rest of the field. Sense and Sensibility and Il Postino both would have been like, oh, this is the year we're going artsy with the Oscars. I really feel like it should have been Apollo 13.
I can work
for for Best Picture. And I really think that Mike Figgis probably would have been better Best Director, because there are more than two good performances in that movie. You've really got Mel Gibson as a good performance in Braveheart, and then you've got Angus McFadyen as Robert the Bruce giving good performances. And then Patrick McGowan is just, a mustache twirling villain, and everyone else is kind of a caricature. I really think that Best Director should have gone to Figgis, even though I like Braveheart more. I think that the directing was better in Leaving Las Vegas.
I think the best picture from this group was Babe. I really
do. A lot of people thought that it was a great family film.
One that still is an easy rewatch. And I think James Cromwell definitely showed how much his range had improved from being the Skolnick dad in Revenge of the Nerds to being a man who, had a sheep.
Then a couple of years later, being Dudley in L.A. Confidential.
Yeah.
All right, guys, let's get to the real awards here. Let's get to what really, really, really matters here. And that is the 16th annual Golden Razzie Awards. They were held on March 24th, 1996 at Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel to recognize the worst in movie industry had to offer in 1995. For the first time in Razzie history, an actual winner showed up at the ceremony and accepted his award, and that was Showgirls director Paul Verhoeven. Kyle?
This was the year, because of Showgirls and because of the notorious, infamous history of Showgirls and where it was at that point, Kevin, this is the year the Razzies truly got put on the map. And people really started to notice the Razzies. Thank you, Showgirls. Yes,
definitely. So Worst Picture, of course, was Showgirls, but we had some nominations for Congo, It's Pat, The Scarlet Letter, and Waterworld. Worst
That is a top-level killer combo group right there.
I like Django.
Worst actor, Pauly Shore won for Jury Duty, but we had some other contenders. We had Kevin Costner in Waterworld, Kyle MacLachlan in Showgirls, Keanu Reeves and Johnny Mnemonic, and Walk in the Clouds, Sylvester Stallone in Assassins, and Judge Dredd, and Robert Rath as Judge Joseph Dredd. But, oh, that was his character guy. Worst actress.
Hey, Kevin. Isn't the Razzie Worst Actor Award just named the Pauly Shore Award?
Probably should be, but yeah. Worst Actress.
I think Nicolas Cage has won it more times.
Worst Actress, Elizabeth Berkley wins, of course, for Showgirls. Nominee, My Girl, Cindy Crawford, Fair Game, Demi Moore in Scarlet Letter, Julia Sweeney in It's Pat, and Sean Young in Dr. Jekyll and Mrs. Hyde. Worst Supporting Actor, Dennis Hopper wins in Waterworld. Nominees, Tim Curry in Congo, Robert Davi in Showgirls. God, Robert Davi was fantastic in Showgirls. I can't say the line.
Me neither.
God damn it. I can't say anything was fantastic in Showgirls.
I can think of two things.
Yeah. Exactly.
Robert Duvall in Scarlet Letter and Alan Rations. Oh, okay. Yes. In Showgirls as Tony Boss. Worst Supporting Actress, Madonna wins in Four Rooms. Nominees were Amy, the Talking Gorilla in Congo, Bo Derek and Tommy Boy as Beverly Marriage, Gina Gershon in Showgirls, and Lynn Tucci in Showgirls. Worst as
what's her name?
Henrietta Bazoum.
Why did she not get the Oscar for best character name ever? It's right up there with Casanova Frankenstein. Bazoum. Like, you can't get better names than this. Bazoum.
Okay, these are, I love Worst Screen Couple, and the winner was any combination of two people or two body parts in Showgirls.
Except for two.
William Baldwin and Cindy Crawford in Fair Game, Tim Daly and Sean Young in Dr. Jekyll and Mrs. Hyde, Dave Foley and Julia Sweeney in It's Pat, and Demi Moore in either Robert Duvall or Gary Oldman in the Scarlet Letter. Worst Director, Paul Verhoeven, of course, wins for Showgirls. Rennie Harlan for Cutthroat Island.
Robbed.
Roland Jaffe for The Scarlet Letter. Frank Marshall for Congo. Kevin Reynolds with more than a little unasked assistance from Kevin Costner for Waterworld. And last,
could this have been the year where just they could have made it? Everybody wins. Everybody gets a trophy.
And last but not least, worst new star goes to, and this is interesting that Elizabeth Berkley wins as a new star for Showgirls, when of course we all know her as Jessie, but also nominated was Amy, the Talking Gorilla in Congo, David Caruso in Jade and Kiss of Death, Cindy Crawford in Fair Game, and Julia Sweeney, Stewart Saves His Family. So anyway, there we go for the Razzie Awards. Anyone want to make a comment on the Razzies, or shall we move on?
It was a strong year for the Razzies, but just remember, you don't know me.
I think in every category that Showgirls won, there's at least two worst in that category.
I don't know. I remember that pool scene and go, yeah, that was a pretty bad film.
Yeah, but then there's It's Pat.
Well, yeah, I just want to let you know, Alex, that we will answer your prayers. We will be doing a Couch Potato Theater on Showgirls.
Oh, I can't imagine a reason to listen to that. Oh,
you'll want to listen to it. Trust me.
Can I be on that one?
I'm going
to
be honest.
Because I need to rewatch Showgirls real quick.
I actually own the DVD set of Showgirls, which comes with the documentary Showgirls, the greatest movie ever made.
I just do want to mention.
But do you have the pin the pasties on the?
Yes, stripper? It's in that box.
This year on Blu-ray is the documentary "You Don't Know Me," and talks about how this movie is a masterpiece, and we will go into that into the upcoming Couch Potato Theater of Showgirls. So anyway, guys.
Spoiler alert, they're wrong.
I challenge you to watch "You Don't Know Me" first, and then come tell me again that I'm wrong. But I'm just saying.
Yeah. Okay.
Lee, you seem excited.
I want to see these guys fight.
All right, guys, let's wrap this up here. First of all, let me give your final thoughts on 1995, the movies. Alex, I want to start with you. Thank you for coming in on this this last part. I know there was a bunch of other movies you didn't get a chance to talk about. I didn't know if there was anything else that stood out for you that was not covered in this final quarter of 1995.
I feel bummed that I got to miss out on it because in the third quarter, you got to talk about Angus, and I love that film. A wonderful thing. And it's very strange to find a kids movie who three of the adults in it are Academy Award winning actors. And it's all being done by the, by the record producer for Green Day. So it just goes to show how weird.
And they got a great Green Day single on the soundtrack.
Oh, they got a lot of Green Day on that soundtrack. Yeah. It's a very, 95 was an interesting time. And it's weird to look at it 25 years later and go, oh, my God, I'm that old. Because I was 23 in 95. And that was like when I was hitting my stride, really, on picking and choosing what movies I want to watch and really delve into. You had films like Suspects and everything like that, but truly, I definitely feel that of the films that we got to see that were nominated for Best Picture, of the five, Babe still holds up. And that's a rarity in film, is to get to see films that stand the test of time.
95 was such an interesting year for me because I did make the change moving from Alaska, where I had spent my entire life, down to Florida. So that became kind of I being in Alaska, a lot of blockbusters, so a lot of movies watched, but being someplace that, you know, you had so many different types of theaters open to you where you were going to see movies that there was no way it would have hit the theater in Alaska, like Mallrats. So that was eye-opening. But when I look back at 95 as a whole, I think it's one of the more, you know, every year has its high-point movies, it has its low-point movies, and a bunch in the middle. The variance between the top of this and the bottom of this and the films in the middle is so all over the map in 1995, more than many years I can remember. And I think it's what makes 95 swinging, because you have some films that are just mind-blowingly good. And then you have just some films like, what were they on? What were they thinking? How did this even get greenlit? Where did they get the money for this? And it's just, it's so dramatic in 95 and so all over the map that, and it's so interesting because there's a lot of careers that really took interesting directions in 95. This is a big year for Robert Downey Jr. He was doing a lot of work before he had his second major relapse.
Antonio Banderas, and it would have been, man.
There is, yeah. This was, yeah. I mean, so it was very interesting. I think 95 goes down as one of the more interesting years in Hollywood history. Maybe not the greatest year, but there's a lot of interesting things that happened in 95, movie-wise.
Lee?
Well, anyone who's listened to the first three chapters knows just how personal all these movies are to me, having put them together, worked around them, made the friends, worked in the theaters, and gotten to enjoy them for free, or for minimum wage, I should say. This is has been a fantastic walk through my own history. Actually, we were talking about the Goo Goo Dolls earlier, in their song Name that premiered in 1995. They've got a line in there. Grown up way too fast, there's nothing to believe, but reruns have all become our history. And here we are. We are kind of, you know, not quite as cynical, but we are enjoying the history that we all share, you know, growing up in different corners of the world. But these moments for all of us spoke to us similarly, but in very different ways. And here we are still all around the country talking to each other about this. And I think it's kind of amazing. And especially here in the Twin Cities, they've had movie theaters shut down just completely closed. Like you can't even go into them for the last 4 weeks, and it'll go through the New Year's. Remembering movie theaters. And once they're safe, I'm going to be the first guy back in the seats again. But this has just been a fantastic walk down memory lane for me. thank you so much for letting me be on all four.
Well,
of these
you qualify, man. You're a movie nerd like us, and you got an interesting perspective by putting them together and watching them for free and stuff. But I got to ask you guys one last question. I'm just gonna end my take here was that the 90s for me, specifically the early 90s, and 95 is right there. That's when I started becoming what we call cinephiles now, a movie nerd. You know, this is when I started to realize how. I was curious how movies were made and getting interested in screenwriting. Pulp Fiction did that for me. I was like, that opened me up to screenwriting and a bunch of other things, behind the scenes stuff and who played what and what did they do beforehand, you know? And of course, a book called The Bare Facts helped with that as well. But I want to say for you guys real quick, is this when you started becoming a movie nerd, Alex?
Right around this time. Yeah. You mentioned the screenplay for Pulp Fiction. For me, it was Swingers, Favreau. And that was one of those ones where I saw the movie and I was like, I want to read the screenplay. And then you get films like L.A. Story and other ones where, you know, just the writing of is almost better than watching it. And I suppose that's how books work. But anyway, the end result, though, is to be able to sit there and be able to relive all of that. And you had directors who were taking chances, guys like Robert Rodriguez, guys like Tarantino, who were really guys, Kevin Smith. Obviously were the new kings of Hollywood. But at the same time, you've got Scorsese hitting unquestionably his best mark ever. You've got people who, you know, unknowns, the screenplay for Usual Suspects is legitimately a master's class. And I know that because they use that in a class on screenwriting. It's you know, right at this time that but again, and everybody's going to have that. We're going to have that those 1 to 2 to 3 years where they're just going to see a bunch of movies they've never seen before, and it's going to shape how they look at movies from that point on.
Good point. Kyle, last words on that?
You know, I think for me, movies have always, I can't remember a time when movies weren't a part of my life where, I mean, even younger days, but because of where I lived and the aspect of isolation in the wintertime and Blockbuster Video becomes, and video, your local video rental stores become a major part of entertainment. You rent 5, 6, 7 movies because it's 60 below outside and you're not going outside to do anything. So, but I think what happened for me, especially around this time, is again, this is when I made a major change in my life. And like I said, having some more windows open to me as far as being able to see movies when they're out in the theaters, when they're movies that I would never get a chance to see until they hit video otherwise, kind of opened up how I approach going to the movies. I mean, even in Alaska, even in the wintertime, I was going, if not once a week, at least once every 2 weeks. But again, it's what happens here in this, around this time. I'm 20 about this time. Your view changes. How you approach things changes. Your life view start becoming more your own. And I think there's a lot of films in here that really did develop and start making those changes. And I think kind of over the period of the year before, from 94 to about 98 was really, I made it a point to really expand my horizons in film. And I think that's kind of where that's why this in this time is so special for me in here.
Lee, you working in a movie theater, I can assume you started appreciating movies, but I can also assume you having to watch some of these over and over again, you were getting sick of certain ones. But how did you not get sick of movies with you having to see these all the time? Or was it because you got to see a lot of these over the time, you started to appreciate the process of them?
I had always been kind of a movie nerd. But this really allowed me to be in it for the kind of the first time. Just being in the final product, you know, once the butts are in the seats, that's the end result of a movie. Being there, I will say, as much as that job sucks sometimes, there is nothing like the electricity of a Friday night opening. I mean, Batman Forever opening night. I don't know that I've been as tired. I definitely wasn't before. And since, you know, maybe basic training or fighting, I've been more tired. But that was just an absolute insanity because we had shows running, I think, every 40 minutes. And the lobby would just fill up constantly. And you had to cycle people out crazy. But this really did crystallize a lot of what I had been about as a movie nerd. And then it kind of moved me forward. And the experience of watching them the night before, just to make sure that everything worked right, and the ability to rag on the movies when they're bad and just love on them when they're good, led me to this. Also led me to, you know, you're posting pictures from going to the premieres of Rogue One and Force Awakens. I do that with any movie I can. And because of you, I actually did the suit up for John Wick, Kevin, for John Wick 3. I'm like, that's a great idea. And I got all my friends and I posted.
I remember that.
I think
yeah.
I tagged you. Before we'd even spoken on Zoom, I'm like, I just want to
suit
thank
up for
Kevin
Wick.
For this great idea.
That was fun.
Yeah. But it's, you know, just a great time. And I won't even name them all, but everybody that I worked with at the Cobblestone, the Century 6, the Forum 4, the Fleur 5, the Westwood 11, the Century 11, and the Valley Cinema in downtown Des Moines, all those places, you know, getting dragged back and forth to all these different little cinemas, seeing things, just changed how I go to the movies. And it's I still do it as close to that as
well
I possibly
said.
Can
well
every
said.
Time I can.
Guys, I know this has gone long. Thank you, guys. We wanted to definitely give you guys all a chance to talk about this. Alex, thank you so much for coming on.
Always man. A pleasure.
Lee, as always, see you on Blood of Kings. Appreciate you. And Kyle, yes, well, I'll see you soon. We're doing all kinds of podcasting together. So, yeah.
I thought I was going to see you in a particular year.
Yes.
Zemeckis Cube action is going to happen.
With that said, thank you all for joining me and everyone else here on Time Warp for 1995 Part 4. But join us next year, coming very soon, actually, for Time Warp 1981. In 2021, the movies of 81 will celebrate their 40th anniversary, and we will cover movies such as Raiders of the Lost Ark, Porky's, Mad Max 2 Road Warrior, For Your Eyes Only, Escape from New York, Evil Dead, Das Boot, Excalibur, The Cannonball Run, American Werewolf in London, Clash of the Titans, Heavy Metal, Chariots of Fire, Dragon Slayer, Nighthawks, Gallipoli, The Great Muppet Caper, Enter the Ninja, and one of the best movies of all time, Condor Man. Until next time.
The greatest Superman movie, greatest superhero movie of all time, man.
Until next time, I'm Kevin, and I will see you in 1981. Goodbye, everyone.